Welcome to You, Me, Empathy, a safe place for leading with your heart. Hey, thanks for being here. You, Me, Empathy is the official podcast of the Feely Human Collective, a collaborative mental health community designed to empower each of us to grow our capacity for empathy, vulnerability, and emotional wayfinding. Just a friendly reminder that this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. No one is just a silly boy with a feely heart. You can support the show by leaving a review in Apple Podcasts, following us on social media at Yumi Empathy and Feely Human, and joining the Feely Human Collective community at feelyhuman.co. And now your host, Known Wells.
Hello, Feely Humans. Welcome to another episode of You, Me, Empathy. My name is Known Wells. I am the creator and host of this podcast. I'm also the Feely Human Collective founder, where we explore and grow our capacity for empathy, vulnerability, and emotional curiosity. You can learn more about that at feelyhuman.co. It's where all the show notes for this podcast are at. Feelyhuman.co is where you go for that. This is episode 212 on what it means to be human in the world with my guest, Daniel Opong. Daniel and I, in this episode, explore moving beyond our binary bunkers, how we can be more seen and understood as people, breaking free of our predetermined identities, and why diversity, inclusion, and equity work, or DEI, is at its core about what it means to be human in the world. Really, really loved this conversation. Really love and appreciate Daniel and the beautiful work he's doing in the world with The Courage Collective. You can learn more about The Courage Collective at thecouragecollective.co. That's thecouragecollective.co. That is also linked in the show notes at feelyhuman.co. Before we get to the episode, though, a few very exciting things happening in the Feelyverse. The first one is the ongoing emotional check-in series I'm leading and hosting. It's a third Friday of every month where me and Feely Humans from across the world get together and be witness to each other's wholeness and show up for each other and all of our Feely vulnerable humanity. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. We had the first session and you can still be a part of it if you like. If you like that, if that sounds lovely, go to feelyhuman.co, click on the banner at the top and join us. The other exciting thing is the As We Carry On workshop. It's As We Carry On, using words to explore your grief with a compassionate lens. So it's a grief and writing workshop led by my friend Katie Huey of 52 Beautiful Things. And I will be hosting. It's on February 6th at 11 a.m. Pacific time. That's 2 p.m. Eastern time. That's this coming Sunday, February 6th at 11 a.m. Pacific time. That is $25 to join. It's a 90-minute beautiful interactive workshop where you'll explore how self-compassion can help us live more fully after loss. It's beautiful. I highly recommend it. Again, it's this coming Sunday at February 6th, 11 a.m. Pacific time. You can sign up for that at feelyhuman.co if you go to the workshops tab and click on As We Carry On. The last thing is that I am leading my Illustrating Empathy workshop, a workshop that I've done in person a couple of times for some colleges and have done on online virtually. But for the first time, I'm doing it at a bookshop. One of my favorite places in the world is an independent bookshop. And I recently met Sam, the owner at Arvida Book Company in Tustin, California. She's wonderful. And she's just created a beautiful space in Arvida. And I am very excited. So I'm leading the Illustrating Empathy workshop in person at Arvida on February 20th. It's February 20th at 10 a.m. Pacific time. If you're in the SoCal area, February 20th at Arvida in Tustin, California, I highly recommend you join us. I'm only selling 20 tickets. A few of them are already gone at this point as of this recording. So get your tickets now if you have any intention of going. Very excited to do that. It's $20 to join. We'll be in this little outdoor space at Arvida. It's a beautiful little space, and I'll be there. We'll get deep, deep, deep on empathy and what it means for us individually and collectively, for our hearts, for our softness, for our curiosity, for our growth. So if you want to learn more about that and sign up, do so ASAP. Go to you can go to illustratingempathy.com or go to feelyhuman.co. Click on the workshops tab and click on Illustrating Empathy. Again, that's February 20th at 10 a.m. Pacific time in person at Arvida Book Company in Tustin, California. So those are the three very exciting things that are happening in the Feelyverse. The last thing I'll say is I am working on the Dear Childhood Me journal that should be coming soon by the end of February, hopefully. I'll have a limited edition sale, essentially. So look out for that. Stay tuned for that. Very excited about the journal coming soon. But let's get to the episode, shall we? This episode, again, with the beautiful Daniel Opong on what it means to be human in the world. Enjoy. Welcome to You, Me, Empathy, the official podcast of the Feely Human Collective. On this show, we explore the struggles, the triumphs, the brights and the darks we face as humans trying to get by on this wondrous and overwhelming pale blue dot. The intent of You, Me, Empathy is to talk openly, without judgment, about our mental health, our neuroses, our shared anxieties and worries, to create a dialogue that is vulnerable and deeply human and empathetic, and to share that dialogue with others to inspire emotional and cognitive collaboration and insight so we can, hand in hand, break down the stigma that make us feel shame and guilt for struggling, for feeling our feelings, for being feely humans. You, Me, Empathy is a safe, friendly space designed to inspire the beauty in each of us. Today, all of us Feely Humans together are collectively cheerful to be here with DEI consultant and founder of The Courage Collective. It's Daniel Opong. Hello, Daniel.
Oh, and thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh, so happy to have you, friend. I did sort of in my day job, the listeners don't know this, in my day job for SPI, we were grateful and honored to have you and your team there and sort of walking us through some of these very deeply important ideas and concepts. And I was like, I got to have these people on the show. In fact, I reached out and will be recording with ECs and Mari as well. So,
Amazing.
Getting the whole team on board, You, Me, Empathy.
I love it. Yeah. Thanks for having us. Both ECs and Mary, they're fantastic. I know they're stoked about the conversations as well. And so really enjoyed getting to work with you and the GPD team. Excited about this conversation today.
Yeah, likewise. So Daniel, we always kick off the show with an emotional check-in. How are you feeling?
Love the question. Let me create some space to answer honestly. I feel... I feel a lot of gratitude today. I'm feeling a lot of gratitude. And when I think about where I was last year at this time, last year was a lot, right? And so I fast forward 12 months and I'm thinking about where I am right now. And in this moment, I feel gratitude. I think I've experienced some cool things. Just got off of a really fun travel bender. Got to go to Florence, Barcelona, London. Feeling grateful for that. Feeling grateful to be in this space, have meaningful conversations. Feel pretty light too. My work schedule hasn't been too jammed. So feeling good. How about you? How are you feeling?
Hold on. I want to do a follow up. First of all, how dare you? This is my podcast. I'm just kidding. The gratitude thing, how are you? So, you know, we're recording this at a time where, you know, the Thanksgiving holiday here in the States has just happened, and gratitude and sort of giving is a cultural thing that's happening. It's part of the sort of narrative of this time. Is gratitude something that you hold and think about year round? Is it something that you pay attention to?
Good question. I feel very conscious of where I've been, just in life in general, right? Like I think about just my overall story arc, and, you know, I think in the last couple of months, I've had experiences that I don't know when I looked at my life maybe a decade ago, did I think I would be here? I don't know. Probably not. I had different intentions or plans or ideas. And so kind of settling in to now, it's just a consciousness of the different twists and turns that life takes. But to be in a place right now where I feel like I feel connected to myself, I feel connected to the people around me, I feel my feet underneath me in a way that just feels really good. Yeah, that's where my gratitude comes from. So I think in this moment specifically, it's just a consciousness of combination of experiences that either felt elusive or didn't feel attainable or felt far away or that I couldn't have imagined. And here I am in that space feeling centered there. So yeah, it's a present moment reality, not the commercialized version, but like a sincere one. So
I'm just going to let the listeners in on a little bit behind the scenes. So we paused for a moment and I asked Daniel to please find some headphones. And I'm going to be totally vulnerable with you, Daniel, right now. Like I think in the past I would have just let it go a little bit because I feel like I've always been this sort of like helper type to the point where it's like to my own detriment, right?
Yeah.
And I've never been good at sort of like asking for what I need, right?
Uh-huh.
And it makes me think about what you just said about gratitude in regards to like as we sort of grow into our things, into our passions, right? Into the things that we love doing, we begin to clarify those things for ourselves.
Right.
And as we clarify those things, like it becomes such a richer experience. We start seeing more nuance and more detail mm-hmm. in the work that we do. And that is the space, like that nuance and space in as we sort of clarify our paths and our space in the world. That's the stuff that lights me up.
Yeah, I love it. Well, good for you. I'm glad you said something and didn't internalize it. Like if that's growth, I'm here for it. So
I love that. Well, you asked the question how I'm doing. I'm doing pretty well. I continuing to do this podcast, it brings me joy. It makes me light up. I get to talk to lovely humans like yourself and learn new stuff all the time, and it's a joy, and I'm very grateful for it. And even though like independent podcasting is a thing that can be make you feel like you're just talking into the ether, like no one's listening, I do know people are listening, and I have to remind myself of that.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah. So can you give me, this isn't a question I haven't asked in a while. Can you give me a couple of snapshots from maybe your childhood or youth, memories that sort of stick out in your head as being sort of integral to who you are now?
Yeah, it's a great question. A big question trying to distill to a few. It's interesting because I just spent Thanksgiving with my family and we're all my siblings. So I'm the second of four. And so we were all reflecting a little bit on our upbringing, how we grew up, and specifically in that context, my parents are from Ghana, West Africa, right? So they immigrated to North America in the mid 80s. And so we grew up with parents who lived the majority, like a chunk of their adult life in African culture, and then raised my siblings and I in American culture. So we were just reflecting on kind of the stark contrast in upbringing. So one practical example I think about, my dad's a PhD, he's an academic, right? So he's associate dean of grad school, he's done that his whole career. And in Ghanaian culture, education specifically is like the pinnacle. So one experience I can think about, and we were kind of reflecting on and laughing about, maybe more commiserating than laughing, but my dad would send us, so you know, you have your typical report cards and then your progress reports. My dad made his own custom version for my sister and I.
That's amazing.
And he would send us to school, maybe. He would send us to school with these progress reports, and we would have consequences if we had any missing assignments. And the specific experience we were reflecting on was my older sister. Like, we just got to this point where it felt very like performance driven and not feeling super seen. It was more about what we achieved and not that we tried. Right. So I just remember a very specific experience where we both got in a decent amount of trouble, and we were both a little bit apathetic as it related to some of the work. And for us, because there wasn't space to process that emotionally, it was kind of like we just swallowed it and kept moving. So when I think about how that informs how I show up in the world now, one of the things that I value and care about a lot is being known and being understood, because I think for the longest time, you know, I had to shelve some of the things that were deeply important to me just to be like, okay, I need to move through. And anyway, I think it's just a cultural value and difference that I can think about that informed how I show up and even what I value as it relates to relationships with people now.
It's really interesting. I really like, what a beautiful example and such a clear example of how we can sort of, I mean, parents can be, parenting is hard, blanket statement, parenting is hard. And sort of the best of intentions can still sort of, put your kids into a space where they feel like, they just have to like, okay, I have to do this. This is what dad says or mom says or whatever. And sometimes that is a space of bypassing part of ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. I know for me, like, it was a lot of like, okay, I need to like sort of armor against my dad and my sensitivity, right? And and I'm wondering what it was for you. Like, what were the things, like, if you're reflecting back, like, what were the things where that were silenced, the things in you, Daniel, that were sort of like, I want to grow this area or I want to explore, but like the system maybe felt I couldn't or whatever.
Yeah, great question. I think that's part of, like I said, the growth over the last, I would say, decade. Because I think, you know, with my dad, when I think about where he came from, so I feel infinite empathy for him. His dad left him when he was little and, you know, he worked his ass off to get to where he is today. And also, like, had to be pretty focused on what he was doing in order to make it. Like, when we went back to Ghana in maybe 2010 or 11, and I'm like, I look at the little box and village specifically that he grew up in, and I'm like, wow, like, if I was in his shoes, would I have known what to do and how to make it to where I am? I have no idea. How do you get to America? I have no clue, right?
Yeah.
So there's a level of empathy that I can feel for that. But I think what it created, and he, you know, he was just pretty myopically focused on what he thought was important. And so I think what it created for me was, maybe not feeling seen or invested in the things that I valued, right? Mm-hmm. And so my probably response was, here's what he knows, or the space that I can, the sandbox that I can play in here. And here are the things that I value that I will go a different route, and kind of compartmentalization probably is, it was the result of that and not feeling fully integrated, or like I had to go outside to feel more known and seen. And, you know, it's been great to reconcile that over the last probably decade or so. But I think that was one of the main challenges that it created for me personally.
Yeah, that's understandable. And have you had conversations with your father since about these things?
Yeah, probably when I went to college. So all my siblings went to school where he teaches. My path was divergent from the jump, right? Mm-hmm. So I think I just took a different path than my siblings off top, which in retrospect, my student loans maybe are like, maybe should have gone with the tuition discount, but here we are. But yeah, I went to different school, went to play sports, and that kind of created some of the necessary space for me to do some of the self-reflection and processing. And it's been cool to like have him support and show up in different ways, especially recently. But yeah, a lot of work and intention gone and has gone into some of the evolution and growth there.
Yeah. I'm also the second born of four children. I guess that's like middle child, you know, a bit of the middle child. Yeah. Did you feel like, because I certainly felt it. I felt like I wanted to be a bit different than my sister, who's the oldest, right? Did you feel a bit of that? I mean, it sounds like you did a bit of that.
Yeah, this is what we were reflecting on and laughing about the other day. My siblings and I, so my sister and I are 11 months apart. So she is like, super close, Irish twins as far as age goes. And so I think the bigger question, and I'm curious about this for you too, the bigger question for me was like, as a kid, how do you get your needs met? And how do you get what you want? And so what we observed, or what I observed with my older sister, is like, to a certain degree, she didn't get some of the things that she wanted. I mean, practical things, right? So when we think about coming from Africa to the States, prom is not something that is material or important. Getting a car when you're 16, having a cell phone, like some of these practical things.
Yeah.
And so I would watch her kind of ask, and if my dad said no, you know, not push back, kind of just accept it. Follow the rules, feel a lot of responsibility for us. And I'm like, she's not really getting the things that she wants. I'm like, well, that path doesn't work. I need to try something different. How am I going to get my needs met? Right. And so I think I took a different approach, rather unsuccessfully, I think. But yeah, it was kind of that whole question, like, what can I do to, one, be who I want to be and be what feels authentic and kind of break out of this predetermined or prescribed identity, and then two, how can I get my needs and wants met? So definitely a different path.
And the other thing too is like, you know, maybe sort of empathetically sort of looking through the lens of the parents, like in a sense, kids don't know what they want, right? Like, and how could they, right? And how could they, you know, it's like, you know, it's why, you know, parents will say like, you know, this is what's best for you, right? Like, but yeah, you're right. Like it's maybe a sort of, maybe it's somewhere there's a balance in between of like allowing your kid to like go create your things and like providing a bit of that sort of structure or expectation, right? Yeah, no, it's tough. Did you, so growing up, you sort of were sort of mixed in between these two cultures, American culture and Ghanaian culture. Uh-huh. What, and I'd imagine that felt maybe a little sort of wayward, a little sort of like, which one do I value? Which one do I like? How was that feeling for you?
I think the feeling was a lack of belonging in either, right? So there's a level of assimilation we did. And I think this is probably true with a lot of immigrant families. It's like, you assimilate a little bit so you can feel a sense of belonging to one culture, American culture, but also don't totally feel a deep sense of belonging within that culture. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the juxtaposition of not feeling a true sense, kind of, but not really in one. And then when we went back to Ghana, same thing. We don't speak the language. We don't understand all the elements of that culture either. So yeah, I think it was kind of this mix of being on the outside looking in, sometimes on the inside looking out, sometimes kind of oscillating between those two ideas and just wanting to figure out like, what is it for me that gives me footing, that gives me value? And I think fast forwarding a little bit, part of it came through sports. That's part of my own story. Like, I remember when I was younger, so seventh grade me, I was like this short, like pudgy kid and like, not good at sports. I kind of was just, you know, whatever, played, was on the B team. My coach at the time said I was a lover and not a fighter and a big teddy bear, and said I look like a roly poly, all these things that are antithetical to like, you know, sports culture. Eighth grade, I grow a little bit and grow into my body and get good at football. And immediately my social circles, the world around me changed. And I remember thinking in eighth grade, nothing is different about me than besides the fact that I'm a little bit better at sports. So why did that also change the whole world around me? So I think the deeper feeling and looking was for like, what is it that gives me a sense of belonging? And I think yeah, finding that through sports, for better and worse, actually.
Yeah.
But finding that there, that was kind of one of the things. It was kind of a safe haven, but also became a bit of a kryptonite too.
I so relate to that. And there is that, yeah, there's social capital in being a football star or being on the team, right. Right? There's like, and it does give you some protection. It does give you a group, you know, and yep. and that can feel good and that can feel safe and you can feel seen in that. But there's also the thing that a lot of groups can do, which is like sort of obliterate the self or sort of like make it harder to define the self within the group, right? And when you're a teenager, totally. Like that's especially hard.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, and I think probably true for a lot of sports, like the hyper masculinity kind of machismo vibes. And I never really related to that. Like I was always more, I just saw people felt deeply and cared a lot about that. So my coach was right. Maybe he was trying to throw shade, but he was right. But yeah, I think about that for me personally. I'm like, that's more where I identified. And then you get in the college locker room. I actually did this men's group 2020 summer. And we talked about just how formative the high school locker room or men's locker room is and how that shapes and informs shame and self-protection and, you know, trying to measure up and this kind of inherent competitiveness that men feel and measuring up, all that stuff. So kind of being thrust into that environment and having to figure that out. Yeah, it just was a really interesting and complicated journey.
It is interesting and complicated. And I do hope that in the work that you're doing, in maybe the work that I'm doing, we start to disentangle a bit of that hyper sort of toxic masculinity that exists in those spaces, right? I was just reflecting on this week, which is like, I posed the question, what if we didn't have to win? You know, there's so much emphasis on in business, in culture, in entrepreneurship of like winning, right? Like we got to win. And yes, like that's how sports are set up. There's winners and losers, but like,
sure.
But there's like implied sort of like a second class citizen. There's an implication that like you're less than, right? I have this distinct memory, Daniel, of this kid, in middle school wearing this no fear shirt, like, that said on the back, no joke, second place is the first loser. And I remember like in the fifth or sixth grade being like uncomfortable with that notion because I'm also a lover, not a fighter.
It feels
gross to me. And it does, to be honest, it does feel like it's sort of an oppositional force to what the work that you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's interesting the ways in which we're conditioned to think about winning or success and what it means to be great or be even the notion of greatness, kind of the inherent implication of like being better than. And I think that to me just feels like a pretty futile end. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that I realized even in playing sports is like, there probably is always going to be someone better. And even if it's not today, like tomorrow or the next year, the next decade. And so there's kind of this fleeting nature of this pinnacle. And I think I experienced that. I ended up playing and I tore my ACL a couple of times, which totally impacted my football career. But it kind of crystallized the reality that in that world, you're replaceable because the coach has to win to keep his job. And if he doesn't win, he's done. And if you're not helping him win, then you're on the... So right. Just the reality of that perpetual cycle. And so winning is interesting to me because what I've started to do even over the last while is try to reimagine, what does that even mean, right? And less about what I accomplish externally, but like, how do I want to feel about my life, about my relationships, about the things that I'm putting my energy towards, like to experience or accomplish things externally, but then create a life you don't feel present in. That's not success to me. That's not winning. And some people would say it is. And so I've had to kind of deconstruct those ideas largely because of some of my own experiences and ask myself, like, how do I want to feel and how do I create that? That to me feels like a life that I would love. I want to create a life I love, right? And one that I feel present in that I don't have to escape. And so I think that's kind of been what I've evolved and kind of reshifted my focus to.
I love that. It's I think you used the right word. It's integrated. And it's moving away from the sort of the childhood experience you had of like, let's just compartmentalize this and not integrate any of these sort of big things. Because the real work is internal and external. And those things are sort of intrinsically connected. And if we're not cognizant of that, or if our systems sort of deny either part, like we're not, like it's not, it's futile, like you said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
I love that.
Totally.
So Daniel, in your sort of quest to belong, to find belonging and to be seen and to be heard, did you ever struggle with anxiety or depression or loneliness or anything like that?
Really interesting question. I think that I would say yes, but it's nuanced in the sense that a lot of my value came through performance and like what I was able to achieve externally. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that I realized about that, and I learned this lesson pretty difficult, like in a pretty hard way, two different times in my life. The first was in playing football. I experienced a sense of belonging by being good and, you know, showing up in sports. And then I tear my ACL. And I remember the feeling, right? So I talked about how my dad was, right? And kind of this, you know, this is the way, superimposing these values. Football became my identity and created social capital and all the things that you mentioned before. So then when that was gone, not only did I lose my ability to do something that I enjoyed, I also lost a part of my identity and a part of myself, right? And so what I felt as far as a feeling of belonging, gone. I ended up getting a scholarship, go to ACU, play football, you know, reboot again, because I'm like, I have to, like, it's all I know. 3 months into my time at ACU, I tear my ACL again, same knee, same day, exactly a year apart. And similarly, it was disillusioning. And I think the thing that was compounding there was in college, you understand the business of sports. You're there to fulfill a purpose. They give you money to do it. It's transactional. If you're not doing that, you don't belong, period. Like, it's kind of that simple. So that happened. And then my next thing, I get involved with a faith-based organization and I'm working there and doing this whole thing. And my value, again, came through what I could do, how I could perform. And I took on a lot of responsibility, ran with this thing for 6 years, long story short, end up losing my job. And I remember thinking in that moment, this is when I was 24, just bought a house and like, you know, and I don't have a job. And I remember that was probably one of the loneliest I'd ever felt, because I realized all these things that I'd invested in to feel a sense of belonging, the moment I wasn't operating in that role and function, it was gone. People didn't know how to relate to me, to connect with me. And one of my own self-reflections is like, all I gave people in that environment was the role and function, not my authentic self. So I had onus and responsibility there too.
Yeah.
But also the jarring reality of, you're valuable here so long as you perform. And if you don't, where does your value come from? And I think it did. It was one of the, pretty disillusioning and a pretty lonely place, and kind of made me ask the question of like, what the hell did I do all that for? Which got me to the point of, I want to prioritize how I want to feel. It's less about the external achievements, you know? So,
yeah. What a beautiful insight that is. It is, there is so much in the world that, I mean, you've experienced this yourself. We've all experienced this sort of feeling like that we are there and we are valued for the doing and not the being, right? Not like who we are. It's like what we achieve, what we do, the boxes we check, whatever it may be, right? You know? And what I love about the work that you're doing now with the Courage Collective is it's not about sort of the checkbox of DEI, right?
Right.
These huge, deeply foundational ideas and sort of moments of critical thinking and thought and emotion. That's not a checkbox. It's this ongoing, nonlinear, messy human experience, right? Mm-hmm. And to get there does require that internal and external and all of it in between. And we can't do it alone, and we have to do it
right.
each other. And I think, you know, I'd imagine you were very intentional about using the word collective. I did as well for Feely Human, because it's about all of us, right? And because it's about all of us working together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 100%. Yeah, I think that's so true and resonates for me. DEI is interesting lens to apply to this conversation, just because I think at its core, we're talking about the human experience at work.
Yeah.
And, but also what it means to be human in the world, right? Like, I think about just more broadly, some of people's best and worst experiences have come at the hands of work. And so how can we make work more human and create intentional spaces where people can show up and be seen, and your unique differences, there's space for them. You don't have to assimilate to belong. You can be your authentic self, feel valued, feel seen, have an impact, feel supported. Like, that's the heart of the work. And one of the main sessions we do is around humanizing. Like, I want to create space for that. What are the collection of experiences that inform how you show up in the world? How can we create space for that? And if we can see each other in our humanity more clearly and recognize the unique things that make us different, like, what a beautiful space that could be. That's kind of the intent for me. And I think it goes beyond the transactional, check the box, external results approach, and kind of focuses more on the human experience, which I think is why I got into it in the first place.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about, like, some of the things that you've witnessed in organizations and work cultures when you're sort of maybe witness to some of that humanizing, some of that vulnerability and opening up and people sort of sharing their backgrounds and sharing their very unique experiences. Like, what can you describe, like, what that looks like and feels like to be witness to?
I think about the power of story and human story and how no person on earth has the exact same collection of experiences at all. And when you can create space for the unique experiences that people have, it kind of creates this reality that in our humanity, we're probably more similar or have more shared experiences than we are different, but also maybe I can't relate to that because that's not me, right? So, like, it's this beautiful mix of your uniqueness is deeply valued and we're part of the shared experience that is being human. That's kind of what we get to see. And I think for me, one of the things that's been most profound about it is when you get into these, like, I was actually having a conversation a few minutes ago. We work with a consulting firm. You get into these cultures and this consulting firm, this type A high achievers driving towards results. And then you ask them, like, what are the unique collection of experiences that inform how you show up in the world? It takes you off of this conceptual performative plane and, like, no, who are you at the core? And so to see the ways that people have had to connect with or even reflect on their own identity and talk about, this is who I am, and to see the shared experiences and light bulbs go off. So many companies have been like, I've worked with this person for a long time and I never knew any of these things about these people.
Right.
Right. And so, I mean, on average, you spend 90,000 to 100,000 hours of our lives at work. And we don't even know some of the people that we work with. So, like, why not? Why can't we create that space? It's been really profound and meaningful. I think disarming in a way kind of gets people to that sense of feeling that I think they're looking for too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You want to experience that feeling of connection, right? So
absolutely. You know, like, I speaking from experience, you know, just working with our team, we've always sort of had this foundation of, like, let's be open. And I feel like I've been one of the sort of the arbiters of that sort of that value within our team, you know, working with our team for the last, I don't know, 7 years or whatever. But there is one thing to have awareness and knowledge about your fellow human, right? Within an organization, within a community. So that's one piece. Like, how do we go from that awareness, that knowledge piece to, you know, doing the work of empathy and equity and inclusion and all of that stuff, right? Because that is making that step one to step two. And maybe there's probably many steps in between. Like, how do we go? How do we make that that leap?
I mean, if it were linear and a checklist, a lot of people want that from us, right? Like, tell me what to do and I'll do the things. And, you know, I think, you know, when I reflect on summer 2020, I think that's a lot of what we saw. It's yep. kind of, people are feeling, right? They're feeling awareness, they're feeling shame, they're feeling loss, they're feeling confusion, all of it. Yeah, guilt. And instead of creating space to feel the feelings and process the feelings, a lot of folks moved into more manic action to try to absolve the shame. So what can I do to alleviate this deep feeling that I don't want to feel and perform my way out and make it better? And I think that's what we see in a lot of DEI work is tell me what to do. Give me a checklist. What are the things that I can do right now? And if I do those things, it'll make everything better. And I'm like, not like, we got to create space for the reality of the human experience, because even if you hire more people, what are they going to, how's it going to feel for them when they get there? Are they going to want to stay? Do they feel seen? Did you create the environment with them in mind? And so I think part of the work that we try to do is like, let's move off of this transactional checklist that actually doesn't really see the humanity in people. Let's create space for the human experience. And from there, design our systems, strategies, policies, procedures, approach, value proposition with humans in mind, right? Yeah. Like, how do we do that? That's what we try to guide people towards.
Yeah. I mean, I think there, what you're saying is very true of just the work of sort of working on your own mental health, right? It's ultimately about sort of working on the ability and your capacity to feel your feelings, to sit with your feelings, to build awareness of self, to build awareness with your people, your communities. It's really the work of empathy. Like, you use the word radical empathy. I saw it like on the Courage Collective site. And empathy, to me, the real work of empathy is not in the sort of like, let's put ourselves in the shoes of another. Like, that's part of it. But the other part of it is like, how can we like truly listen and be present for all of the mess of it, right? How can I, as someone who's like this sensitive, like, you know, skateboarder punk kid, like have empathy or find empathy for the guy who drives the big truck with the truck nuts, you know, like how do I bridge that gap? And it's not about like, let's all get along. It's about like, can I abandon my own bias? Can I be aware of my own bias, my own misconceptions? Am I assuming things about these people, this group of person, this community, right? How can I be aware of all of that and drop a bit of that armor and be as present and curious as possible?
Totally. It's super interesting that you say that, because I just think about how polarized society is just more broadly. And when you're talking about empathy, I go to the place of, can I see my own humanity in the eyes of my enemy or oppressor or the person who I think I have literally nothing in common with, or the person that infuriates me? I think oftentimes we take empathy to the level of like people that we agree with, and we can connect so far as we agree. But when you get into, you know, I think about just, I won't diatribe on politics in this conversation, but when think about just, my opinion about it really is more, it feels like similar energy in different directions, right? And we have different ideals that, you know, people are espousing and championing and different hot button issues, but the energy is the same to me. And at that level, like, people are kind of doing the same thing and wanting similar things, but like the rhetoric and the villains and the heroes in the story are different, but the energy is the same. And so if what happens when we get beyond some of our binary bunkers and actually get to the place of empathy and like, yeah, the person who has the monster truck that's loud and obnoxious, they probably want to feel a certain way that's probably akin to something I would want to feel too. Yes. Maybe the way that they go about doing it is different than the way that I would go about doing it. But the desire for experience of feeling valued or important or seen, or like, that's an innate to humanity, right?
Yes.
And so when I can get beyond the external expression and say, like, what is the feeling that this person is seeking? It's a different conversation, right? It kind of connects us with actually the essence of who we are and gets beyond some of the other stuff that clouds that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're really like finding the root of we are human. This person's a human too. Let's start there, you know, mm-hmm. to begin with. Yeah. No, I love that. It's really important. So one important sort of piece of this type of work in DEI work and empathy work, you know, mental health work, like, is safety. Like, what is, when you think about safety and creating safe spaces, what does that look like to you? What does that feel like?
What does it feel like? First thing I go to is it's disarming. Hmm. The things that we normally do to protect, we don't have to, right? So when I think about creating an environment in which people can be known, seen, valued, and accepted, it's essentially that. Like, I think one of the ways that we go about it at the Courage Collective is we try to norm around certain ideas and kind of create, if you will, guardrails for how we want to relate to one another. Mm-hmm. And it's so fascinating, right? Like, once you name things that, like, growth looks different for everyone. Oh, chill. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Or, you know, we can hold two truths at the same time, or learning and unlearning are part of the process. Things like that, that are just, when you name them and you can collectively acknowledge that, like, hey, yeah, we can agree to that. What is impactful and transformative for you may be elementary for someone else, and both of those things are okay. Like, when we can normalize those ideas and just name them, I think it is disarming inherently. And then I think also just modeling vulnerability. So one of the things you mentioned earlier, like, yeah, sharing our own story, talking about our own truth, our own things that we're processing and how we're experiencing that, I think it goes a long way. And I think for me, the other thing, last thing I'll say on this is, I try to personally, anytime I'm in a space or session, I want to engage the leaders, right? Because I think about, one of the funny things about consulting is we're only there 3 or 4 hours out mm-hmm. of the whole 7 years you've been at SBI. Mm-hmm. And y'all have to live that day to day. And so we're not privy to or aware of the reality of what it means to live that culture every day. But if we can engage the leaders to model some level of vulnerability, take a risk, be open, that creates something for the people that are in the environment, right? And so I think that's one of the other things that we try to do in order to create a safe space for folks.
Yeah. Yeah. That's important. And I, you know, it's interesting because I, you know, as I reflect on the experience that we had with the Courage Collective at SPI, I personally, and I think this goes to what you're saying in sort of like the inherent sort of reality of cohort learning, which is, you know, I felt like it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And it was stuff I knew and had been learning for the past few years, right? And I remember like at that very, there was 10 minutes at the very end where like Pat said something and I was like, ooh, this is good. Let's dig into this, right? And I was like, yes, I want more. Like, this is the stuff I've been waiting for. But That isn't to say like, oh, I'm farther ahead. It's not about that. It's just about like cohort learning. That's part of like when you're teaching a concept to a team, some people are going to be like learning new things and some people aren't. And how can we sort of, I mean, I guess like you probably have to think about that as a team. Like, how can you have to start at the foundation, right?
Fascinating, right? So like we actually had a big debrief about this after a couple of sessions. And so if you think about education and just systems of education and group learning, like you're talking about, as an educator, teacher, facilitator, the idea is that you would teach to the top of the bell curve, right? So you have people who are really advanced, you have people who are novices, and then you have everyone in between. And so the idea is like, you would want to create kind of this optimum, like, let's teach something that has relevant and is relevant kind of top of the bell curve type idea. The interesting thing with diversity, equity, and inclusion work is that even within identity groups, no one's a monolith. So even in that, the bell curves are different. So you can have 10 Black or African American folks who all think about the world and the work very differently. You can have 10 white folks who think about the world and the work very differently, 10 LGBTQ folks, and so on. And so when you go into this space, it's like, how can we, that's part of the challenge, but also the opportunity. The group spaces for me are more just a catalyst to invite and model certain types of conversation. The biggest misnomer is if people think that that's the end of it. Right. Like if you think we're going to come in, have 3 hours worth of conversation, and that's going to be like game, set, match. Like yeah. you're it's not like, that's, on the yeah, right.
Exactly. That's the checkbox thinking.
Yeah, that totally. But for us, we think of it as like, how can we be a catalyst and introduce concepts, create space, invite a level of dialogue and vulnerability? And I think we have some adjacent things that we do that kind of support the learning, but really we want to be candid, like, hey, this is just the beginning. For some people, it's just another step in the journey that they've already been on. We want to make it interesting and relevant to all the folks, but know that it's an ongoing journey, that there's so many different angles that you can continue to take it on.
Yeah. It's one of the things I say often is like all of this, all of the richest, most important stuff that we sort of focus on in life is ongoing. It's
of course
non-binary. It's non-linear. It's messy and it's humbling. And yeah, it's all of the things. Have you in your work for the Courage Collective, have you seen any or heard any like resistance or like, cause like, I know our group was like, we love you. You're the best. Like, have you had experiences where it hasn't been that?
Oh, of course, dude. Yeah. No question.
Like, mean, I assume I didn't want to assume, I guess.
Yeah. 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 Fair. No, I think, specifically with this work, I mean, part of it for me, and even the way that we approach it, we do education, but we want to index on things that aren't like the idea that we all come from somewhere isn't a debatable concept, right? And so how can we take these overarching frameworks and embed specific learnings that will make people understand, you know, key terms and whatever, mm-hmm. but what are these things that actually connect with what it means to be human and how do we embed those into conversations? But yeah, man, I mean, I think when you talk about things like systems of power and privilege and different ways that different people have been disenfranchised or marginalized, the shame that people feel, the defensiveness. Yeah, we've had conversations where it feels for some folks that it's kind of challenging the way that they see the world.
Yeah. And that's scary.
And challenging. Yeah. And challenging what they've known to be true and challenging the things that maybe they've gotten identity from or value from. And our MO isn't to go in and be antagonistic or say people are right or wrong. I don't like those binaries in general.
Yep.
But I think what's interesting is when you're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion work and even nuances like race and intersectionality and sexism and historical oppression, you know, I think people feel a lot and what they do with those feelings. When we look at the story arc of history, it can feel a little overwhelming sometimes or debilitating. And I think people have different responses to that. Mm-hmm. Some people will bark and bite. Some people will totally pacify themselves. Some people will lean in. Some people will try to manic action their way out of things. It's a whole collection of responses for sure. But I think we just try to continue to bring it back to being courageous, being empathetic. The work is ongoing. This is a moment in time where we're learning and how can you continue that? So
yeah, I love that. I wonder if, and I'm certain that groups and companies are doing this work too, but I wonder if like, because it feels like, I mean, obviously the DEI work is integral. It's essential. And I wonder if, and it's really where I want to take my business is like doing, like trying to, like working on the, and focusing on the individual sort of like, let's talk about that shame. Let's talk about that guilt you're feeling. Like, how does that feel? Because really like a huge piece of it too is like that individual, like, you know, you said it before, ability to sit with your feelings, knowing what those things are. And to your perfect point, like when those things are disrupted, or if you're not ever used to doing those things, it can feel very jarring. It can feel life shattering. You know, you can, your identity is attached to this one framework. And if that's sort of disrupted, then what the hell are you going to do? Right. It's a scary experience. So yeah, there's a lot of nuance in there.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So what is, you know, I know that Courage Collective has been out, you guys had launched just over a year ago. Yeah.
2020. I think our first session was September
2020. Yeah. How is that going? Like what's, do you have big goals for this next year? Like, how is that feeling?
Yeah. It's been a whole ride, honestly, known. Like it's been fascinating to me to kind of just watch and see, because I think there are a couple of things for me to name here. Like, on a personal level, to be a Black man and going into organizations and holding space or creating space or initiating dialogue around the human experience, largely through the lens of underrepresented folks, it's really, really interesting. Since I've started, and we've worked with, I don't know, since we started, somewhere between 20 and 30 companies. And I think I have talked to, in the sales or like the, you know, that whole process, maybe 3 Black or brown people. And so one of the things that's been fascinating is the gatekeepers who are deciding what is appropriate or what they want into the organization often don't reflect the underrepresented people in the organization. And so what they perceive as the problem, rightly or wrongly, not good or bad, it's different than the way that other people experience the organization.
Yeah.
So that's been an interesting point of dissonance. And I think also just the nature of our society and like kind of the urgency and immediacy, culture of immediacy that we live in. People want things yesterday. I can get on my phone and order something from Amazon and it'll be here before I wake up tomorrow morning. And people want the work to be the same. And I'm like, that's delusional. Like, that's not real. Like, and so I think that's another layer that we've experienced, probably more on the challenging side. But I think it's kind of like helping people evolve the expectations and say like, nah, like you said, this is ongoing. So that's probably more of the bubble that we've had to burst. I think on the positive side, it's been so profound to create meaningful space for human stories and to see people who maybe didn't feel like they had a voice, feel like they have a voice. People who didn't feel seen, feel like they are seen. People who didn't have systems created with them in mind, feel like, oh, wow, I can actually show up here and vocalize what I want and need. And there's value there. So I think that's been another great part. As far as big goals and ambitions, yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of things. So I'm an entrepreneur. That's kind of my vibe. And so I'm kind of, I've always been pretty imaginative, we'll say. And so going into 2022, there are a handful of things that we're excited to launch that are going to be kind of adjacent, but all focused on creating value and making impact in this space. So we're launching a brand 2022 called Boundless, which is going to be more of a talent acquisition platform to create access for Black and brown folks in marketing, consulting, and tech. So that's one that we'll be launching.
Awesome.
We are also going to launch a brand called Courage and Community, which goes to your specific point of 3 sessions. It's fine. It's great. It's a starting point.
Yeah.
But the work is actually ongoing. And so Courage and Community is going to be more of a cohort experience where we do deeper dives into some of the learning, dig into some of the nuance and actually focus on more of the work in a more meaningful and focused way. So that's another thing that we'll be working on. And then, you know, continuing the consulting and training bits as we have energy for it. So yeah, it should be a fun ride ahead.
That's tremendous. It's exciting. Very excited to hear. It made me, so one thing you said, you being this entrepreneur, one aspect of sort of this work I've been thinking about a lot is capitalism, right? The system of capitalism, right? And, you know, at SPI, we sort of help people launch businesses and things, right? And we're existing in the system of capitalism, which, as you know, historically is terrible, right? You know, and sort of like the part of me like that is sort of the punk rock skateboarder wants to burn it all down, right? Let's obliterate it, right? How do you, as an entrepreneur, and then even sort of in the context of like going into businesses that operate within the space of capitalism, how do you reconcile those things?
Yeah, that's a super meta question. Love it. Here for it. I was actually talking to one of my colleagues the other day, Michael, and we were just talking about just how money is kind of a necessary illusion in a way, right? Like, and just thinking about, for me, we talked about winning earlier, and I come back to that. Like, one of the things that I've been really curious about, even in my own business, is like, I see a lot of the ways that kind of capitalism and even the popularization of entrepreneurship through Silicon Valley, like some of the things that that incentivizes and some of the ways that it motivates people to create businesses. And so as I've observed all of that, for me personally, I'm like, how can I build this in a way that actually feels aligned to my values and what I give a shit about personally? Mm-hmm. So that's been one whole path and journey. And part of that includes, like, you know, Silicon Valley would say, start a business, raise a bunch of money, hire a bunch of people, do all these like big campaigns, you know, all that stuff. I worked in venture capital for, you know, 5 years. And so I kind of saw the exchange of currency and solving a problem and how there's money to be made, right? Yeah. But for me, I've been asking myself, like, how do I do that in a way that feels authentic and where I don't create this thing that I despise, right? Like, you think about the people who create these businesses that they then feel trapped in and want to escape. I'm like, oh, so that's one piece of it. But I think going into organizations and you know, I think a lot of the questions we'll get sometimes is like, they want to know about the bottom line and scalability and, you know, whatever. And I'm like, until we're all replaced by robots, like there's a real human thing here that we have to figure out. And for me personally, what I've said is like, if we don't align on values and why and the impact that we want to make, like we're just not the right partner for you. And so I've been able to kind of draw those boundaries and say, like, this is what we care about. This is what we value. We're motivated by impact. We won't even take your money if we don't feel like it's going to create what we want to create. We're not incentivized just by, there are a lot of things that you can do to make money. But for me, it's more about alignment to values. How can we create the impact that we want to create? And if that's not with you, okay, like we'll find the right partner to do that. And so that's been interesting. And I think because of, I mean, in 2020, and there's all this research that talks about the size of the DEI industry and the lack of results and all of that stuff. So I feel a personal maybe mission to, like, if people want to just check the box, and they'll pay me even a decent amount of money to just check the box, I'm like, that is antithetical to the core of the work. And I won't take your money to do that because it actually is going to be more detrimental in the long run. And so for me, off top, I'm like, nah, this, if this isn't aligned with our values and give us energy and create the impact we want, keep your piles of money. We're going to do it in a way that feels good and increase the impact.
Beautiful. I love it. It makes me all warm inside, Daniel. Thank you.
good softball question. That was a good one.
You bet. So let's start wrapping it up. We always kind of at the end of the show, Daniel, talk about our empathy heroes. So people in our lives who are empathetic, compassionate, feely, could even be characters from stories we love. I will go first and name my empathy heroes this week. I'm just going to name the Courage Collective. You're here. The team at the Courage Collective, you'll hear from ECs and Mary soon, listeners, but just tremendous work that you are all doing and I'm proud of and I'm grateful to have been witness to in a small way as a human and grateful for your part in progress and your part in vulnerability and empathy. Like it's very admirable and it's very exciting to see. So thank you. And yeah, Courage Collective, everyone, check them out. How about you? Empathy Hero.
Can I do a couple?
Or
I
need of course. One? Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So first one that comes to mind is one of my colleagues at the Courage Collective, Nani. Shout out to the whole team because they're all incredibly fantastic. But Nani, I'm thinking about specifically just in the way that she has created intentional space for me to feel seen and heard and supported, just in a really meaningful way. And, you know, I think when you're, for me, when I'm in a position of like leading and, you know, running after something and pursuing the vision and all that stuff, I think it can be a little bit, depending on how you set it up. I try to be intentional about humanizing myself, but it can be a little bit like lonely, or it can be a little bit unforgiving sometimes. And so today and this week, I'm feeling especially thankful for the ways in which Nani just creates space and for me to feel seen, supported, empowered, and for other folks on our team. So all love to Nani. The next one I would think about would be my mom. Got to spend some time with her. Her name is Comfort, which epitomizes her essence. And yeah, I think about the environment I grew up in, and I actually got to tell her this week, and I've told her ample times, but she just saw us in a way that I don't know, for me and my siblings and I, like, I don't know that we had felt. And so she's an empathy hero for sure. And then the last one, I was listening to Brené Brown on Glennon Doyle's podcast.
So good.
And this morning. Yeah. And I just think what I appreciate about her and her work is she just normalized some of this language. Other people have done it too, right? She's not the only person who's done this work, but something about her work normalized the language, even in some of the settings where it feels harder to. So one of the companies we work with, they're actually going through a whole Dare to Lead training for the whole company, which focuses on courage and vulnerability. And so I think about Brené Brown normalizing some of that, making it accessible in a lot of environments. So I consider her an empathy hero as well.
Great. Great list you got there. I love it. I love it. Well, Daniel, where can the Feely humans out there connect with you and learn more about the work that you're doing in the world?
Yeah. So I think our website is a quick place to go. So thecouragecollective.co. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Personally, I think IG would be a place. So _Daniel05. And I think generally, you know, as we launch some of our new things, we'll have some more direct connection points through Courage and Community where people can just get in touch and vibe with us. So, you know,
amazing.
More to come on that.
Yeah, very excited. Well, Daniel, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for being here and being vulnerable and just proud of you as a human.
I appreciate it, Noam. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to you listeners, as I always say, I'm here, you're here, we're here together on this wayward, overwhelming, awe-inspiring, pale blue dot. We have each other. It's you, me, empathy. Oh.